Blog Talk Radio.
Now, PW Torch and Spreaker bring you the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show. It's time to talk this week's AEW Dynamite on TNT.
So, Brandon, final hype for Full Gear tonight on Dynamite. Was there one match that stood out above all others for you?
I have a couple, and I think both of them for kind of the wrong reasons. So I'll start with the main event, Jon Moxley and MJF. I thought that what Moxley and MJF did themselves was relatively strong. I thought it was marred somewhat by the interference of Stokely Hathaway's group, but I thought it was really hurt by the just general lack of reaction from the crowd. I sort of thought that, you know, Moxley got a much more subdued reaction than he typically does. And then there were some boos for him when he was kind of cutting down MJF. So I expected naturally that the crowd was just heavily siding with MJF and that they'd come unglued when he eventually came out. But that really wasn't the case, even when he was making the save. They popped, but it certainly wasn't the type of reaction that we've grown used to seeing with MJF. And he really had to do some extra legwork there to kind of get the crowd on their feet. And when they were face-to-face, kind of going back and forth there for that brief period of time, there was just so little reaction. So I thought that was harmful. The other one that I would point out would be Saraya and Britt Baker, which, again, if the goal is to make Saraya the babyface here, I thought they did a disservice by letting Britt cut that promo.
So two major topics. You covered both. I think the crowd reactions, the lack of crowd reactions we're seeing lately, is in WWE and AEW. And I'm not sure why. Sometimes it's just the city. You know, it's just sometimes cities, it's just a down week. Mm-hmm. But I agree, it wasn't explosive. Even when Death Triangle were trying to get the crowd to chant Elite, mm-hmm. like 14 people chanted Elite out of sync, and then they all just gave up. Mm-hmm. that is not what I think anybody was hoping for who was part of that. I think they've sent way too many mixed signals to fans. You know, even Jade Cargill and Nyla Rose. I mean, you can watch that with the idea being that Nyla's a hero for taking the belt from that loudmouth Jade Cargill and making her whine and cry about it instead of, you know, and she's got to come and get it from her. Or you can look at it as, what's Nyla Rose doing with stolen property? Just win the belt in the ring. Do you have a sense of who they want fans to cheer, or do you think they don't care and don't think that's important when it comes to that match? We'll kind of work our way through here.
I mean, I get that sense with so many matches on the card, that one included. You bring that one up, and it's true. Like, as I was watching the promo package that they put together for that match, I'm just thinking, like, okay, so Jade has been a heel all this time, and so you think that that's what they want you to, you know, continue to do is boo Jade, but stealing the championship belt and calling yourself the champion when you have no claim to the title doesn't make you a babyface, especially in the face of a champion who has been so dominant. So yeah, I don't get the sense that there's any clear direction there or that they really know who we're supposed to be cheering for. And that extends even beyond the two matches I mentioned, the one you mentioned. I think they're presenting that challenge with the tag team title match. Yes, the Acclaimed are clearly babyfaces, and Swerve Strickland has very much been erring on the side of being a heel. But Keith Lee is still a babyface. I mean, there's still some confusion there. So there's just so much conjecture and confusion regarding so much of this card.
Yeah, I think at some point, you know, Tony Khan has to decide if having clear-cut baby faces and heels is important to him. And I think if he decides that it is, I think the best route is to simplify characters. And I don't mean dumb them down, but I mean simplify in the sense that they are consistently one type of person that you're confident the fans will either like or not like. Moxley's been consistently likable. I don't think there's anything Moxley's done to turn fans against him. But other than matching him against MJF, when MJF has been one of the most popular guys in the business. You know, just I wrote about this week's Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter cover story. I dedicated the whole story to, in terms of previewing the pay-per-view, just to Mox and MJF, and talked about kind of the four options that AEW has. You know, MJF wins the title as a face. He wins as a heel. He loses, but leaves as a face. He loses, but leaves as a heel. Either way, MJF's leaving as a babyface, and I kind of run down the path and in the options there. I don't have a sense for it. I have a sense that the firm and Stokely and company are going to be involved in the finish, and I don't, or the match in some way. I don't think fans like that signal being put out there. And there's Regal standing around, not exactly getting beat up badly by the firm, but being held off. You have the mystery of how does he feel about MJF showing it up and reading that email. Does MJF try to use his brass knuckles? How does Regal react? Is he in on it with MJF? There's so many options, but I just think the crowd doesn't know what they want come Saturday. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one ex-wrestler messaged me after last week's Dynamite and listening to my podcast and just said, you know, what the best way he thinks, and I'm paraphrasing, to sell tickets, to sell pay-per-views, is to give fans a definitive outcome that they want. And then a little sense of jeopardy, it might not happen, but make them think it's likely to happen and tune in to watch something they want to see happen. And then, you know, you deliver what they want, you know, 6 out of 10 times. You got to, you know, stretch things out and make things a little more difficult for the baby faces to achieve what they want. And I just don't think AEW's done that with many of the matches, certainly not the top matches. Even Jamie Hayter and Tony Storm, you know, Storm's not getting a big positive reaction, any reaction at all. Hayter's getting a mixed reaction, but mostly cheers. It did seem to radiate throughout the whole show, and it's weird, but right now the Acclaimed are getting the best reactions. I think with what AEW had to work with and the booking choices they made, I think they did a good job promoting the pay-per-view. I disagree with some of the booking choices, but I think the idea of it's sort of a pick'em between a bunch of wrestlers who you respect or you think the stakes are high and you want to see what happens and you don't know what's going to happen, I think they did a good job with that, with the video packages and having the stare down at the end and hitting certain beats. But I think if you asked AEW fans, who do you want to see win on Saturday? I love Mox not knowing what night it's on. Although MJF might have said Sunday first, I'd have to go back and review the tape. But I think most AEW fans who are going to order the pay-per-view are like, yeah, I've got my favorites, you know, going in, but the booking didn't really sway them. But mostly they just want to see good wrestling. And I think AEW will grow to the next level when they steer fans definitively through the framing of top stars, steer them towards definitively wanting to see a certain outcome, not just wanting to see the spectacle. And I agree with you. That's one of the downsides. And if the crowd was going nuts, if we were seeing crowds like we saw the first couple months Dynamite was on the air, I'd step back. I'd go, yeah, Hey, this is working. You know, and I would. I'd be like, you know, there's the way wrestling has worked in the past, and it's worked in lots of different ways. I think the easiest, best, and most timeless way is clear heels and faces 19 out of 20 times in big pay-per-view matches. There's always room for exceptions, and those feel really special when they happen. But they're not getting crowd reactions. You know, rating, you know, viewership is a little bit up from last year during, you know, the similar stretch, but it's about the same. You know, so holding court maybe is good, but if I'm AEW, I'm aspiring to grow, and I'm not quite sure this approach is going to lead to growth in ratings or in buy rate. I said a lot there, Brandon. Go ahead and chime in.
Yeah, I think that you kind of hit the nail on the head with the idea that there's nothing that seems like a clear path to root for on Saturday. Because, yes, MJF could win the title, and it could be a really cool crowning moment and achievement for this guy who could potentially be a megastar. But it's also kind of surrounded by all of this peripheral stuff that hasn't been necessarily well-defined, and is kind of has kind of been booked in a way to make it appear as though the main event on Saturday could be terribly overbooked. And I think that is my biggest concern. I trust MJF and Jon Moxley to be able to go out and tell a great story and have a great match and have a good conclusive finish, regardless of the outcome. My worry is that, like you brought up, they're going to involve the firm, which isn't getting crowd reactions. I mean, they've been written out of being, you know, backers for MJF. So they have really no express purpose in the match itself other than to cause chaos, unless they are still aligned with MJF. And then you also have the tease of dissent with William Regal on top of it, which I think is more than enough. Like, if you took away the firm from this story in its entirety, and you're just telling the story of Jon Moxley versus MJF, Moxley has William Regal in his corner, Regal has a history with MJF that MJF exposed, and maybe Regal, known for his, you know, backstabbing and double-crossing and heel tactics, might actually side with MJF when push comes to shove. I think that's a much better story than all of that being in place, plus the prospect of these guys interfering when none of them are particularly over on their own. And I look at someone like Ethan Page, who had a big win earlier in the night with Stokely Hathaway in his corner, and I thought that worked. I thought the combination of Ethan Page and Stokely Hathaway is good. I think they work well together. I like the visual aesthetic of it, and I think that there's something there, or they can cultivate something with Ethan Page. But, man, all these guys around him, W. Morrissey and the Gunn brothers and Lee Moriarty, I don't know. It just seems like a bunch of guys that they just don't have anything else to do with.
Yeah, I think there's so many moving parts. And it was,
yeah.
I like, when I was writing the cover story this week for the newsletter, I was like, man, there are so many things going on here, so many options. I don't think they steered the audience towards a particular outcome. I'm hoping the particular outcome on Saturday is one where we look back and everything falls into place. And if that's, you know, and I covered a few of the possibilities in the cover story, you know, in terms of the Regal's brass knuckles and whose side Regal is on and all that. I don't think anybody wants to see MJF join the firm and have the beatdown the firm gave him have been part of a work or a momentary lapse in them getting along, and they sort of concoct a story afterwards. MJF's better as a heel on his own, not with Stokely, and not in a group with all these other people. But they might be going that direction, and I don't think the crowd's going to like it. I don't think coming out of this, out of tonight, the crowd is any more likely to – well, I think Moxley gave a straight-up babyface promo. And he had some good lines about MJF. He's only beat one guy in 6 months. I enjoyed him calling out, you know, the fiasco, or I don't know, fiasco is maybe too strong of a word, maybe not, of all the Brian Pillman-esque thing that MJF went through, the worked shoot stuff that I think a lot of people in the locker room might be rolling their eyes at, still not sure who to believe and resenting the fact that they feel worked, and all that. So he brought that up, and I think it was an attempt to kind of, you know, get the fans on his side. But MJF came out and he did what he does in a lot of his promos, which the crowd is like, okay, maybe we'll boo you. And then he goes, I live and eat, breathe this. And if I don't win this title, it's more important to me than food and oxygen. And it's like the fans are like, oh, this guy wants it so bad. I'm totally on board with somebody who wants it this bad. And then he starts getting cheered again. So I just don't know. I'm really curious. I'm just going to be an observer of the happenings and obviously fully judge when hopefully what was a master plan plays out. I got a little worried they're changing their mind as they go, and some of the hints dropped along the way are going to turn out to not actually pay off. You know, because sometimes you get invested in a wrestling storyline, and then the payoff doesn't involve the things you debated with your friends for weeks. And that's the biggest letdown of all. So I just don't know what to expect. I got the sense tonight Mox is winning more than likely losing, but I'm not super confident in that. And maybe that's good, but I don't know how fans are going to feel about whatever the finish is. I think they're going to groan and roll their eyes if MJF goes hardcore heel and cheats to win. But I don't think they're going to be happy if MJF ends Mox's title reign. I think they're going to resent that the match was booked and they had to go this quickly to that. So, yeah, it's I mean, I think it's intriguing. I don't think it's ideal.
Right. Yeah, it's I don't know. I came into tonight's show feeling like, okay, this is a fine card, and it's going to more than likely end with a very good to excellent pay-per-view in terms of wrestling quality, which AEW pay-per-views almost always do. You know, complaints aside about their length, they pretty much always deliver from a match from an in-ring perspective. And up until now, I've been pretty confident in the handling of the booking. And there have been things along the way, like the title switch with CM Punk back at you know, just before All Out and whatnot, where I've been a little bit iffy about how they've chosen to go about it. And I hoped that I came out of tonight with a little bit more clarity and a feeling that the card and the storylines put into the card were a little bit more settled. And I left the night feeling even more uneasy. It feels to me like a show that, this is more about AEW in general, but it feels almost like a house of cards right now, where, you know, if you just blow the wrong way, the whole thing is going to come crashing down, because they're teetering on so many angles with so many different wrestlers and trying to balance so much talent at one time, who are appearing, who aren't appearing, who, you know, might be on Dynamite 1 week or Rampage the next, but then you don't see them for another month or 2 months, and then you have random title matches happening on TV with little to no buildup or promotion. It feels there's a certain sense that they are lacking control. I think that's what I'm looking for in the end. There's just a certain sense that there is no control.
Or that they're hedging and making it up as they go along a little bit, because they're not sure what they want to do, because there's a lot of options. None of them are perfect. They all have every choice, whatever choice they make in terms of the finish is going to cost them some other choices that I don't think they want to regret, but I think they're cognizant of the possibility of it. Let's pause and introduce ourselves, introduce the show, and then I do want to talk about Britt Baker and her lengthy promo, and then Saraya's somewhat brief follow-up later in our thoughts on that, because you brought that up earlier in the show. All right, this is the Wade Keller Pro Wrestling Post Show for Wednesday, November 16th, 2022. And I'm Wade Keller, the host of the program, the editor, publisher, and founder of the Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter and the website pwtorch.com, and the host of various podcasts, including these post shows, every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night, covering Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown. And then also some VIP exclusive shows like the Wade Keller Hotline, The Fix with Todd Martin, Everything with Rich and Wade, and post-pay-per-view roundtables, which we'll be doing Saturday night exclusively for VIP members. If you're interested in my take and the take of the whole team, the whole group going, who are going to be doing the roundtable on Saturday night, go VIP, pwtorch.com/govip. It's super simple to sign up now and get our VIP podcast feed with these shows, by the way, with the ads and plugs removed. So you get all our free shows, the streamlined listening experience without the ads and plugs, and then you also get access to our VIP exclusives. You can sign up through Patreon directly on your Apple podcast app or through our main VIP sign-up page with credit card, debit card, or PayPal. When you take that route, you're a single click away once you get the confirmation email of launching Apple Podcasts and being logged in. You don't have to go to advanced settings or enter a username and password for any of the apps you use anymore. You've got a really good low friction system of signing up. So we encourage you to do that and support us, and we'll give you a lot in return. Full details, pwtorch.com/govip. We are here tonight to talk about the final hype for Full Gear. And the other voice you've heard so far is Brandon LeClaire, who will be covering Full Gear in a written report on Saturday night at pwtorch.com. Brandon, welcome back to the co-host chair.
Thanks for having me. Glad to be here. And I don't make a ton of appearances on the AEW side of things, but it's always a lot of fun. So I'm glad to do this just before Full Gear.
Yes, definitely. This is a fun time in AEW when storylines come to a crescendo, and the payoff to that is on the pay-per-views. So let's give out the phone number and email, and then we'll get some more conversation. If you want to be part of the show, you can call us right now if you're live streaming the show at wadekellerpostshow.com, by the way. You can find the live stream there at WadeKellerPostShow.com or find the link, direct link to the show page, the live stream every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday night on Twitter at PWTorch, and also in my TV reports covering Raw, Dynamite, and SmackDown every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. At the top and bottom of the reports, we include the phone number, email, and link to the show. So if you are downloading our shows afterwards, but you have time after any of those shows ended, you want to be part of the live streaming experience, or you want to participate, that's the way to find us. So the phone number again is 347-215-8558. When you call, push 1 on your keypad. That plays you on the switchboard and lets us know you want to be on the show. You can also email WadeKellerPodcast@pwtorch.com. WadeKellerPodcast@pwtorch.com. All right, Brandon. So I want to follow up, as I said, on the Britt Baker Soraya situation before we get to calls. By the way, we got Javier on hold, Javier Machado. We'll bring him in for a roundtable. So stay tuned for that. We'll get his take on things as he listens to what Brandon, you and I are saying so far on this. The Britt Baker promo seemed to be, in any other world, a clear-cut definitive establishing that she is a babyface. She is the AEW homegrown talent. What she said about Soraya was a reasonable response to what Soraya had said before, especially last week. She wasn't a snob. She wasn't arrogant about it. She was confident. She made a good case for having earned it, even if she hadn't worked at MSG, like Soraya bragged about, as if that made her better than her. She said, but we worked at Daly's Place during the pandemic, although no one will say pandemic or COVID. They just talk in these weird vague terms about what everybody went through, but everyone knew what she was talking about. And she said, we kept the fire burning in pro wrestling during that time while you were sitting out. I thought she scored points. I thought she did so with relative class. And I think AEW fans would go, I'm cheering for her. And then later Soraya came out and wasn't really a jerk about anything. She just said, I'm tired of this back and forth with Britt, kind of called the truce and said, hey, I wanted to be here and I want to fight you because I respect you. So let's go fight Saturday. And it almost felt like she was sort of conceding maybe things went poorly last week for both of them, especially her, and she came off bad, and AEW wants both of them to be baby faces coming out of the match on Saturday, and they're sort of waving the white flag on fans hating or disliking either of them, but they realized they went a little too far last week by having them go at each other so hard. That said, Baker's comments create a headwind for Soraya to get cheered, because I think AEW fans are going to be loyal to an AEW original like Britt, but there's still Saturday and everything they do afterwards. All it's going to take is a good heel, a different heel to take on Britt and Soraya to either bring them together as a team, which they possibly could do, although I don't know how Jamie Hayter would feel about that, or have them just split off and do separate feuds. So that's kind of my my quick take on that. How about you, Brent?
Yeah, so last week with the Britt and Soraya promo, I thought that they both Baker and Soraya in sort of a precarious position by kind of letting them say what they did. I thought that Soraya coming at Britt and saying that she hadn't necessarily earned anything and that she lacked the experience or whatever the term she used was, it undercut not just the rest of the AEW women's division, but also undercut the AEW roster and the product in general, because the company spent a lot of time last year calling Britt Baker a pillar, one of the pillars of AEW. So if she can't make it in the big leagues and she's not a big deal and all these things that Soraya was implying, then what does that say about the rest of the women in that division? And by extension, what does it say about AEW as a whole? So I thought that Soraya really put them in a bad spot there. I thought it really undercut what they were trying to do. And as Zach Haydorn pointed out in his article for PW Torch that went up earlier today, it in a way was a Britt Baker problem because, the content of Britt's promo almost forced Soraya's hand in that direction. So they were both at fault. And then this week, I think, like you said, they needed to pull back a bit. But what they wound up doing was just making Britt Baker out to be a complete babyface. I mean, I don't see how you can cut that promo and turn it somehow against Britt. I mean, the fans were cheering her. They were cheering that as she delivered her lines, and like the fans weren't cheering much all night. So, I mean, that should essentially tell you that the fans viewed it as a babyface promo. I just don't know what they're going for here. I mean, Saraya came in and there was the will she, won't she idea of whether or not she'd be able to wrestle. And I think we spent a lot of time wondering about that, and that halted some of the momentum that she had. And then pairing her up with Britt Baker, who the crowd has for a long time been wanting to get behind, I think just sends the wrong message that, you know, she's the person to cheer for here and not Saraya. So tonight, instead of clearing things up, I think they just muddied the waters even further. And at this point, I don't know that Saraya doesn't get booed on Saturday.
Is, how do you feel about Saraya being booed and turning into the outsider heel who thinks she's better than everyone else? I don't know if that was the intention to lay the groundwork for it last week, but that's what happened, I think.
Yeah. I think at this point it's what you should do. I mean, we would often get on WWE a lot and criticize WWE for not listening to crowd reactions. And for a long time, AEW had the luxury of booking in a manner that more or less followed the same path that their audience was on. So their audience was dictating, you know, reactions, and AEW was delivering pretty much exactly what they wanted to see. But we've seen some separation in that and some disconnect over the last year or so. And I think this is going to be one of the bigger examples of it. I just don't think, with the way that they have presented Britt Baker, and I mean, maybe she's going into business for herself with these promos. Maybe she can't help herself. I don't know where the blame ultimately lies, but the fact of the matter is that she or the company has presented her in a manner that would suggest that she is the babyface in this feud. And couple that with, you know, some less than stellar promos from Saraya along this journey so far, and her stumbling, losing her way a bit, I think that there was certainly some blowback in the online community to maybe the way that she communicated with some fans who were getting on her about her relationship and the comments that she made about WWE after just, you know, going in the Players Tribune to praise them and her time there. I think that rubbed some people the wrong way. And so they're now in a situation where the homegrown talent who's defending the brand from this outsider is kind of the clear babyface. And I think you have to go with it. I think yeah. that when Saraya came in, I very immediately, and I meant it, I said, if Saraya is cleared to wrestle, then you need to go with her as the face of the division. And you don't, like, I don't even think you have time to wait, because that division has been floundering for so long. And Toni Storm, who they thought was the answer, clearly is not the answer. They've tried and they continue to try, but the crowd is not getting behind her. And, you know, that can be a combination of the way that she's been booked, the way the title is presented, the opponents, the quality of opponents she's had. But whatever the case may be, it hasn't worked. So I thought, all right, you pivot now to Saraya. But the albatross in the room was still Britt Baker. At the end of the day, Britt Baker is still the face of that division, has been for a while, and the crowd has wanted to cheer her for quite some time. I thought that if they could establish Paige as the face of the division and have Britt Baker be her heel foil, that it could work if Saraya was over enough for them to, you know, side with her over Britt. But the way that the first few weeks went for Saraya, the tides quickly turned. And I think very quickly they have to shift priority. Now, you could still go with Saraya as the face of the division as a heel, but I do think that Britt's got to be your baby face.
Yeah. All right, well, I want to go to an email here that broadens out the topic a little bit. This is Will in Montreal. He says, I have a few points from below that I would love to hear your thoughts on. I've held my tongue long enough. I've tried to break them down to make it easier for you to dig through them. So thank you for that, Will. First, tonight is the last straw for me with Tony Storm's championship run. I've really enjoyed Tony's work in NXT UK and NXT, but this title run is so underwhelming. How can AEW book her to look so weak against Anna Jay, who hasn't had a televised TV match in months? Tony should have beaten Anna Jay in a matter of minutes, but no, she's getting beaten for most of this match and only took over to win at the end. The announcer kept saying that if Anna won the match, she'd get the first title shot after Full Gear. Last week, they announced that Bunny was getting the first title shot after the pay-per-view. Did they just forget? Well, I guess if you beat the champ, you move ahead in line. So you mentioned Tony Storm, and it's not working out. Do you think it's unsalvageable, or do you think it just takes some focus on establishing who she is better and not – part of the problem, I think it really comes through in the women's division, is there's, you know, these two different championships, these two separate worlds almost of contenders going after two separate belts. Britt Baker, the biggest star, doesn't have the title and is feuding with the hot new commodity, Saraya, coming back. And so Storm feels like she's in the background. And my argument with Storm early on wasn't that I think she will for sure succeed as a top centerpiece star, but I believed that she was a good example of somebody who hadn't been defined at a certain place by AEW yet. And early on, they needed to treat her not like a shiny new toy for a week or two, and then lose their focus on her. And she's just sort of in a blend where, you know, maybe you see Ricky Starks, but then maybe you don't for a few weeks. Maybe you see Danny Garcia, then maybe you don't for a few weeks. Like, there's too much of that going on when somebody arrives and then they sort of disappear for a while, or they're just, you know, oh, they might be on Rampage, but maybe not. So people thought this was like, some people thought, oh, I'm endorsing Toni Storm, it's the next great thing. No, but I think your chance to get the most out of whatever she can be is by treating her like a very big deal out of the gate. Mm-hmm. Now, they tried that with Saraya, and she fumbled on a couple promos. She was out of practice, and her character wasn't well-defined. Some of that's on Tony Khan and his team for not sitting down and working out what that character is going to be and then having the foresight to know what the reaction would be to certain things that she said and did. With Toni Storm, they just have to figure out who she is, what her mission is, and have her be treated and framed as a really big deal. And then you're going to get the most out of her. And then if she fails, at least if she fails to catch on as a top star getting those big reactions, at least you gave her the best shot to succeed. And they have not done that yet. So some people just kind of make it on their own. You know, Britt Baker, you know, she, you know, getting injured and interacting with Tony Schiavone and riding around on the golf cart and stuff was like, she just became kind of a star you look forward to seeing. So some people just, it just happens because of their performances. Others need a machine behind them with a focus and a plan and well-thought-out, curated execution. And that just hasn't been the case with Tony. So I'm not ready to give up on her. I think she has a charisma and a good look and is certainly good enough in the ring to be a top six star in the women's division for AEW for the next few years. But they haven't done the job that a promoter rather than simply a presenter of wrestling is supposed to do. A promoter is supposed to do more than just drop someone on TV and let them fend for themselves. And too often, Tony Khan, frankly, does that. And Tony is one of those people who needs a little bit more direction and framing. And ideally not put her against somebody who is a heel who fans love. You know, there's just too much of that going on, going full circle. Brandon, back to you.
Yeah, I think that's notable and worth pointing out with Toni Storm is that I certainly do not think she's unsalvageable, and a lot of that stems from the idea that I just don't think that you can point to any woman in the AEW women's division outside of Britt Baker and Jade Cargill who have succeeded in their role when given an opportunity to be a featured player at the top of the card or to hold the championship. And I think that because you can list Toni Storm, Thunder Rosa, Hikaru Shida, Riho, granted, those women are at varying levels of talent and ability and you know, whether or not I think they can carry a division. But still, they were all at one point or another put in a top position, and all of them petered out very quickly. And I'm not willing to say that, oh, they just keep getting the women wrong over and over again. I think it's more likely that AEW has continuously struggled to book their women in a way that make them feel important. And I think that Toni Storm is a victim of that. And kind of like you said, some wrestlers need the machine to get behind them. Others are able to do it without it. I think Britt Baker did it without the machine behind her, and then eventually she got it behind her, and it lifted her to even greater heights. Jade Cargill was brought in with the machine firmly behind her, and it worked. I think that outside of those two, it's just carousel of changing names. The faces change, but the push and the outcome has consistently stayed the same. And that is title programs, title contenders, and champions who just don't connect on a significant money-making level. So, yeah, I think that Toni Storm can certainly be more than she is. Do I think at this point that she's a person who you can build the division around? Probably not. I mean, I think that maybe I overestimated on that. But maybe I didn't. Maybe it really is just the booking, and she needs some time to sit back, hone her character in, and return to that main event scene. But the problem, like you also raised, is that so much of the time these women are cycled and rotated in and out of TV, and this extends to the men as well, that it's very hard to get consistency with characters. There are guys who benefit from having strong characters and featured roles almost every week on TV. You know, your Chris Jericho's, your John Moxley's, MJF, guys like The Acclaimed right now, like Britt Baker, like Jade Cargill. The list goes on. All of those characters are successful because they're featured on a week-to-week basis. Toni Storm is right now, but she's also an afterthought because of the story being told with Saraya and Britt Baker. So my fear is that once Toni Storm loses the championship and she's relegated to a role below the title where we'd hope she could develop her character, is she going to be able to do that on Dynamite and Rampage, or is she going to be on Dark? Because if she's on Dark, no one's going to see it.
Yes, all good points. I'll continue on this email here. Number two, yeah, we covered that. Okay, so number two, why did the baby? This is what I was wanting to add. I do think Toni Storm should have won more quickly. I think that AEW has a tendency to have wrestlers wrestle long matches because they are trying to protect the person who's ultimately going to lose by having them be competitive. Anna Jay just isn't the right person to do that with at this stage, with Toni Storm needing to build momentum. I don't think you do a split screen two segment match with her at this point. I would have spent that time having her cut a fired up promo that helped connect her with the fans more after the match, as you know, Death Triangle did after their win. You know, I like the post match interviews and have her, you know, she should have something to say and she should be given time to say it. And she should have beat Anna Jay quickly. And had a chance to talk before Jamie Hayter came out to meet her.
It's the same exact strategy that they used with John Moxley with various people from other promotions who were not under contract with AEW and came in and wrestled the AEW world champion in a multi-segment match. That stuff shouldn't be happening.
Yep. Agreed. All right. Two, why do the babyface champions always need a match where they struggle to win right before the pay-per-views? I get the whole point of being a fighting champion, but the challenger always gets to stay in the back and rest up. This would give the challenger a huge advantage, especially on just 4 days rest before the title match. I do get them needing to push a match on TV, but there must be a better way. I might be wrong, but we don't see heel champions doing this, just the babyfaces. I haven't picked up on that. It sounds true. It might be have something to do with just who the champions happen to be, or wanting to portray the champions as fighting champions, or babyface champions being more of a draw for TV ratings. And Tony has his eye on that in sort of a short run priority over the long run priority. Brandon, do you see that as a big deal or something that should be corrected, but it's not a big deal, or what?
It's lower on my list of issues. I think first and foremost, before I would worry about correcting that, I would worry about correcting like we were talking multi-segment matches for people who are significantly lower on the card or the totem pole with the champion just before they're about to have a title defense. And before we move on from the women's title, I wanted to point out too that match is another one that suffers from the dilemma of who to cheer for. I mean, Toni Storm is presented as a babyface and she wrestles like a babyface and she is framed as a babyface, but Jamie Hayter, who is still alongside Britt Baker, who was presented as a babyface tonight, ran out looking like she was going to attack the babyface champion and instead just got in her face like a respectful challenger. So what's the crowd supposed to do now?
Yes. He adds, on a side note, why do heel champions, or any champion really, ever take a non-title match? This is something we'd never see in boxing or MMA. I know, wrestling, but still, I personally feel that having this many non-title matches for the champs dilutes their big matches and makes them a lot less special. Certainly, that's not a problem for MJF. he doesn't wrestle very often. But Moxley, I think he wants to go out there. I think they want to have him in front of the fans, helping to sell tickets, getting a crowd reaction, being a fighting champion. But there is something to be said for not seeing the champion on TV all the time in ordinary matches or non-title matches against someone where it's like, why is he getting a title shot? There's something about putting champions on a pedestal that I see the value in. I don't think it has to be that way, but I do get Will's frustration that there's not clear parameters about how it works. I don't think you get the sense watching AEW that there's a lot of thought booking-wise going into what the story is of why some people are wrestling and others aren't. Mm-hmm. Again, I don't think it's a top-level issue, but the fact that Will is noticing it and bringing it up, I think, he makes his case that it is something that can kind of strike you as odd. I don't know. Some things, you don't want to draw attention to by explaining because there isn't a good explanation. Other things are worth explaining, and it's worth going to the trouble to explain. I'm not quite sure where this falls in that sense. Well, I mean, because I think they want Moxley on TV wrestling for ratings purposes and to give other wrestlers a chance to look strong against him or set up angles for down the line.
I think it should really be handled on a wrestler-by-wrestler basis because, to me, someone like Jon Moxley, it makes perfect sense to me that Jon Moxley would want to wrestle week to week because Jon Moxley just loves to fight. I mean, that's part of his character. So, yes, this person who he's wrestling, isn't a contender for the world title, but Jon Moxley doesn't care. He just wants to fight. So that works for me in the same way that someone like Samoa Joe, I mean, even as a heel, Samoa Joe is a guy who, typically doesn't back down from a fight. So if he's in a bunch of non-title matches, I think it makes sense because if somebody steps to him, Joe wants to fight. On the flip side, someone like MJF and the character that MJF has been presented as, I don't think if MJF is your champion, you want him wrestling on a week-to-week basis because MJF has told you he only wrestles, under the bright lights for big money.
Yes. Yes. I think we need the bigger pattern over time. I mean, I think this – yeah. I don't have a strong opinion on whether Moxley should be on TV in the ring less. And I don't have a strong opinion, sorry, Will, on whether AEW should go to the trouble to try to explain it more or if it's not worth even drawing attention to it. I will say I would like to have a more coherent, cohesive reason for why people get title shots or get a non-title match. I'd like a little more framework to explain it. And why is this wrestler getting an opportunity against Moxley or against any champion in a non-title match? What did they do? I think they do that some of the time, but not consistently, and I don't think there's an overreaching policy in that regard that people understand. And so, I would like there to be fewer tournaments and battle royals and stuff to determine who gets a title shot and tell a larger arching story about somebody getting wins and an unnamed championship committee deciding somebody is worthy based on something other than winning a battle royal or a tournament.
Unfortunately, I think so much of the time the non-title matches come down to we have this guy in the building or we booked him for tonight and it looks like a really good match on paper. And that's kind of been one of my chief complaints with AEW.
Yes, I'm with you. A lot of AEW booking, you know, and there's times where it's just a fun story, you know, like Eddie Kingston and Jun Akiyama. Alan Cunahan has a really good column on that in this week's Pro Wrestling Torch newsletter. So VIP members, I encourage you to click on the link at the top of the VIP page or in the newsletter section and read the PDF or alt text version of it, talking about Kingston's background, being a fan of Akiyama and kind of framing it in a historical context. Very educational. And I think there's room for that, you know, to have that type of match. That said, there's a little bit too much of that with people who should be making money for the company, not making dreams come true for matches that they're intrigued by. And, you know, Bryan Danielson is a bit of a culprit in that regard. You know, his mission statement is have good matches with people he couldn't have good matches with if he was still in WWE. And beyond that, I don't think he's been coherently booked. I don't think people have strong feelings about him other than, oh, it's going to be a good match when he wrestles somebody in a novel matchup. So that's an area that you know, I would not give AEW a great grade. Okay, so his third point, Will from Montreal, I found the reveal of the Elite coming back for the Trios title match to be very underwhelming. Several weeks of really interesting vignettes, and then this? Yeah, and boy, not much of a crowd pop. You know, the vignettes seemed like they were building up some anti-AEW thing. Like, that was my interpretation. I don't know how you felt, but it was like, we had the belts, but now we're wiped away. And we were erased from history. It's like it never happened. Yeah. And it was like they were going to come back and be upset with AEW and Tony Khan for, you know, suspending them and taking them off the graphics and stripping of the titles and not even mentioning their names when they did so. And it's going to be some big, you know, and I wasn't even necessarily in favor of it, but I felt like, okay, they're going to come back with a chip on their shoulder and it's going to be interesting. And now it's like, no, they were just messing around with Death Triangle and with vignettes. And now somehow magically they had a graphic ready to say the match is official, even though Death Triangle didn't know it until the moment the graphic appeared on the screen. It seemed too cute. I didn't think it was very effective. I'm with Will on this. The word he used is underwhelmed. I am too, Brandon.
Yeah, very underwhelmed, very disappointed. I was not a huge fan of the vignettes that they had been doing the last few weeks. I thought that they were on the lower end of AEW's production, and I think especially when you're used to sort of the high-value production that WWE does. Very rarely, like, I think by and large, AEW does a really good job with their video packages and their production. And while it's not quite as highbrow as WWE's is, I think that more often than not, it's close enough that I would have no complaints. And this is one of the very few occasions where I felt like the promos were well below the standard. I just felt like sort of the wiping away and the fade ins and fade outs were just, they just felt a little like low rent to me. And so tonight was just kind of a continuation of that. You just throw the graphic up on the screen and then there's no one on the right hand side and slowly they fade in. It just felt like it was thrown together. It just felt like they just threw it out there at the last minute to remind you that it's on the card. And for me, it was less like, oh man, this is, you know, such a great, you know, great feud, great match that I want to see. And more like, you know, here's another 20 minutes to a five plus hour show. Like, not to say that that Death Triangle and the Elite doesn't belong on pay-per-view, but it goes back to the argument that, hey, maybe you want to take a couple of these matches that you have booked and move them to the Dynamite before the show.
The feeling I got is this is going to be a great match.
Yeah.
And I do think Tony Khan's booking is catering to people who listen to our types of critiques and go, what are they complaining about? It's going to be a great match. And I'm like, right, but that's not everything. Like, the TV companies are not paying for average star ratings. They're not paying for Booker of the Year awards. They're not paying for any of that. They're paying for people watching the show. And you get people to watch the show by making people care about the matches. And, you know, obviously having high quality, exciting matches is an essential ingredient in almost every pro wrestling formula. I mean, I think you can actually make money without great pro wrestling matches. And some might argue you could make more money with everything else really good, like really good, that is part of a successful wrestling formula, and just average matches, then you do a company with great matches that does everything else below average. And people can debate that and you know, snarl at the mere suggestion of it. But there's something to be said for, and I think the Elite Death Triangle thing is there. It's like there's a sort of half-established backstory and hints and videos, but in the end, the hype comes down to, oh, there's going to be a lot of dives and high spots, and it's going to be, you know, a bunch of athletes having great matches and fans chanting fight forever, and this is awesome. And that's not a story, and I think there's a limited audience for that. And I think Tony Khan leans on that part of his audience too much. Yes, Brandon.
My argument for when that gets brought up is has always been the same, and that is just that in this era, great pro wrestling is not at a premium. I can get multiple very good to excellent matches every week from various promotions if I want to seek them out. I mean, there is a backlog of excellent matches that I've been told to check out from this year alone that I may never get to because I don't have the time. Excellent matches aren't good enough to compel me to tune in to 3 hours of television every single week and then spend $50 five times a year on a pay-per-view. Like, I need story with that. And it, because again, I can get great wrestling for free on YouTube all the time. So if you're not giving me consistent logical storytelling that then makes me more excited for the matches, then the matches themselves are, again, something that are really just a dime a dozen. I mean, there are any number of indie promotions that put on great matches at every show and put up their shows and their cards for free online. And I can enjoy those, but there isn't much story behind them, so it's hard for me to get fully invested. But there's some really good wrestling out there. I don't want AEW to be just really good wrestling.
Right. I mean, you want it. That's great if that's an ingredient. I mean, it's
yeah,
absolutely great.
I absolutely want it to be one.
Yes. But there's more to it. I was going to say this email till later, but it's so tied into what we're talking about here. Julian from London, he emailed this, and he actually did email this before Dynamite tonight, but it's about what we're talking about here. I was listening to the recent flagship, and I heard you lay into Britt Baker and Sammy Guevara, among others, for failing to deliver logical, consistent heel promos. I have to ask, is this issue due to their indie roots? The vast majority of AEW talent, up to and including their EVPs, have never wrestled on a big weekly TV show before. When you're an indie wrestler traveling around the country, the most important thing is to get yourself over. You're not thinking about storylines. You're not worried about consistency. You're wrestling for a different crowd each night. No wonder we see promos full of "I can't believe they said that" moments, and no wonder we see matches full of high spots. These wrestlers simply don't have experience of building to something big further down the road. Now, the kicker is that even Tony Khan has never run anything like this. Wrestling is at least as close to running a TV drama as it is a sports franchise. Who can AEW stars go to for advice? Hangman Page has made it clear he doesn't think AEW wrestlers need to listen to anyone. The Bucks and Kenny built their reputation on five-star matches, not hot angles and promos. Are there voices in that locker room that even know how to build coherent weekly storylines and consistent characters? And if there are, does anyone even want to listen? I think that's kind of, you know, what we're getting at, you know, that the, you know, Tony Khan's booking approach about big matches and then the criticism of some of the way wrestlers are presented and the way that they present themselves when they're given free reign. I have no problem with wrestlers doing unscripted promos any more than I have a issue with a quarterback calling an audible before the snap. But you better know what you're doing before you break away from a plan. And, you know, rookie quarterbacks are going to get in trouble if they call audibles. If they haven't been green-lighted by the coach and the offensive coordinator in the NFL, and they screw up. And if it's a veteran quarterback who just can read defenses, can see a change in scheme, can see an opening, can see an opportunity, of course they're green-lighted to take it with most coaching staffs. With Tony Khan, I think there's a bunch of wrestlers who have been green-lighted to say whatever they want because we don't want to be scripted, and it is leading to booking messes. And I would argue enough ambiguity that there's some apathy towards how people are emotionally invested in outcomes. And boy, getting to that next level if you're AEW is not getting people excited just about good wrestling shows. And Tony always talks about, it's good wrestling, great match. It's about pulling people in emotionally to a certain outcome. And then either giving it to them and they celebrate, or having it come up short and they can't wait to see the babyface get revenge. Brandon.
I think that there's only so much that, you know, having a excellent top flight match will ultimately take you when it comes to being a product that needs to be presented weekly on television. I think you have to tell consistent and compelling stories. I think that, you know, WWE has suffered dramatically when they have failed to do that. And I think, like, you know, it's certainly no secret that they're reaping some of the benefit of telling a really successful and great creative long-term story with Roman Reigns right now. And you're just not seeing that kind of stuff happening in AEW. And it's disappointing because, yes, like, providing that the Prudential Center in Jersey this weekend is engaged, they're going to get great reactions and there's going to be a bunch of great matches. But, you know, how a lot of it is going to feel hollow, and it's going to feel hollow because the stories just aren't there, and the stories that they're telling are oftentimes ambiguous and poorly defined and featuring wrestlers who really don't have clearly defined roles.
Yep. All right. Okay. I'm looking at the phone mix. We lost a couple callers here while we were chatting with these emails. So I apologize if you gave up on us. Feel free to push one again or call us back. We've got a bunch of people listening. Not too many people have pressed one. So We'll get to you if you do push one now. But I felt like those emails that I scanned right before we went live made too much sense to cover early on. Our number is 347-215-8558. And feel free to call us now and push one if you want to be part of the conversation. I'm saying that, and I want to read one more email here, and then I want to bring Javier on, unless some other people call up first. JB from Detroit says, "We've talked more so about WWE recently, about the absence of irritants since Triple H took over booking in the summer. During the opening tag match tonight on Dynamite, I noticed a very Vince WWE-like irritant in that the announcers kept mentioning the winning team having momentum going into Saturday's ROH title four-way. First of all, I'm not sure how a random tag match win constitutes momentum for a four-way title match three nights later. Secondly, I really hope we don't get another classic Vince irritant on Saturday night when we get a reverse psychology victory with a member of tonight's losing team getting the ROH title win. I'm fairly certain we will because I think Jericho retains." Yeah, I noticed that. And Shivani, I think, was the one who said at the end of the match, well, this makes, you know, he said the outcome of that match gives us clear favorites going into Saturday night. Yeah, I get the, you know, JB sort of being perplexed by that, especially in a four-way situation. Is that just sort of reflex, bad habit, of a defensible strategy? What do you think, Brandon?
It definitely felt WWE-esque in the way that they went about it. I mean, having the champion lose, presumably because he's set to retain on Saturday. I mean, it was a good match, which, again, like, in a vacuum, a lot of these AEW Dynamite episodes are pretty solid because they feature some good wrestling. But, yeah, I think that it's a bit of a weakness, something that they should be concerned with. I honestly thought that the most glaring and jarring thing in this segment came from Ian Riccaboni, who usually I find to be really, really good on commentary, and the rest of what he did tonight was good. But he said at one point that Chris Jericho was very quickly establishing himself as one of the greatest Ring of Honor champions of all time. And man, did I think that was a sort of a disservice to the legacy of that title, given that it's now essentially a mid-card title in a completely different promotion. And the guy that you're calling one of the best Ring of Honor champions is a guy who has vowed to completely destroy the title and everyone who's ever held it. I just thought that, especially given that Jericho hasn't held the title particularly long, I get that he's beaten a lot of guys, but man, that was really hyperbolic. And I know hyperbole in wrestling is, you know, very common and expected to a certain degree, but I just thought that that was striking to me.
Yeah. Yeah. He also says, number two, the second irritant I noticed that WWE also typically does on its go-home shows is having matches consisting of various matches in the pay-per-view on Saturday. We had the tag match of Claudio and Danielson against Jericho and Guevara, and we had Swerve versus Bowens. Irritant number three, Wardlow doing a dive onto 20 wrestlers and having them all fall over like they're bowling pins. And irritant number four, why the hell is Britt Baker cutting a, without a doubt, babyface promo? They haven't even gotten to her turning on Jamie Hayter yet, and I think this random face turn for a match that already has clear potential face on the other side in Saraya will hurt the eventual face turn for Hayter. So mentioned a few things there. I mean, there's, you know, too many dives in Dynamite and AEW. I think the thrill is gone when it's done as often as it is. You know, having wrestlers face each other who are going to be in the pay-per-view, that doesn't bother me a ton. I think there's a happy medium between what WWE does and not doing them. Maybe AEW is leaning a little too much towards doing them too often. Brandon, your thoughts on his points?
Yeah, there was one particularly egregious dive during the Trios tag title match where everyone kind of congregated for AR Fox to do the flip over the top. And it was like painfully obvious, like they all kind of helped each other up and walked slowly into view in a perfect, like almost like a dancing line, like a conga line for AR Fox to do his dive. And it was really striking. But yeah, I think there's certainly an over-reliance on that stuff. It doesn't bother me a ton, again, that guys are facing each other more so than it bothers me that they're, you know, almost sort of tilting their hand toward a potential winner by having the champion get pinned. As for the women's division stuff, I mean, yeah, like, Saraya was the clearly defined babyface, but the reactions the last couple of weeks seem to have either made them change their mind on that or at least be a little bit more comfortable in muddying the waters with Britt Baker. And with Jamie Hayter, is a turn actually even coming? Because if Jamie Hayter is supposed to be a babyface, she certainly acted like one tonight, standing up to Toni Storm, and Britt Baker cut a babyface promo. So do they need to turn? If they're already both baby faces.
Yep. Yep. I don't know, but I hadn't even thought about just the pace of Britt Baker and the Jamie Hayter dynamic.
Yeah.
And it is, it just comes, I mean, as I mentioned earlier, you know, just we'd be in a better spot if there was one women's title and you had this robust division of one champion and multiple challengers and enough where you had, you know, five, six faces in a clear hierarchy, 5-6 heels in a clear hierarchy. They were kind of switching off feuding and facing each other. The one with more wins got the title shot. But that's not what we have because we have titles for everyone. You know, Lee Moriarty wants a title shot. Hey, there's Hook with a title AEW doesn't recognize, but they clearly recognize it. And on, you know, and people wanting to collect belts because there's so many. So there are some, you know, just things built in that I think make it more difficult. And, you know, that we've been critical of from the beginning with Tony Khan adding so many belts, the whole belts for everyone, every organization, let's bring their belts onto our TV show. Let's water down everything. I think everything would be more clear if there was one champion at the top. It's not exactly related to the Britt Baker, it's a babyface thing, but it is mixed. It amplifies the problem, I guess.
Yeah. And to the point of, you know, Baker and Hayter kind of having this side thing that we forgot about a bit. I think in the early days and really last year, I think when AEW was really firing on all cylinders, one of the things that I really appreciated about the way that they presented their product was knowing that their audience was intelligent enough to handle concurrent stories and parallel stories. So with WWE, you very often see this thing where if a guy is embroiled in a feud with another person, they really refuse to have them interact with other people. So they're very much it's a singularly focused one track feud, so that the stories stay simple and very easy to follow. And with AEW, and that's not always a bad thing. I want to mention, like, I think that works in a lot of scenarios, and WWE typically excels at it, but it does often feel like you don't have to do much thinking to watch the product. And I appreciated that AEW for a while there leaned into the idea that, you know, wrestlers are complex people who can have multiple conflicts going on at one time. It felt less like a scripted, you know, round table of, okay, you're matched up with you this month and then you next month and then this guy then the month after, and more like what you would expect a locker room full of clashing personalities to present itself as on a wrestling show. And I thought that they did a good job balancing that in the beginning. And it feels to me like they've gotten away with it. Oftentimes they've gotten away from it. Sorry. Oftentimes it'll feel like there are multiple stories being told, but none of them are being told coherently. And some of them you just forget about, but they haven't dropped them. They'll just talk to you about them again in 4 to 5 weeks.
Yep, exactly. Okay, JB says, to end on a positive note, while I do find the Darby Sting vignettes weird, they are usually unique and well done. I enjoy them as a change of pace. What'd you think of that? The body bag being body surfed, being dropped into the back of an old convertible, Darby popping out from the body bag and have it being bloodied, and then Sting driving and saying it's showtime. Did I explain that well? Can you make sense of it for me? I mean, it was cool.
Yeah, I mean, that's essentially what I got out of it. I mean, I didn't take anything additional away from it. It was fine. I mean, the Darby Sting stuff typically isn't for me. I mean, I can appreciate it and I understand why people like it and that they do like it. I like the fact that unlike a lot of things on the AEW product, it is consistent. And mm-hmm. So, you know, thumbs up in that regard. It's just not my particular style. I have a hard time getting behind the Darby character. It just doesn't work for me. And that's less an indictment of him and just more of, you know, the style that I enjoy.
Yes. All right. So we're doing good with emails. Appreciate everybody with that. We don't have anyone else lining up with phone calls. I got a couple people on hold, but I do want to bring Javier in because I want to get his take while we're fresh here on our A topics, and he can bring up anything else that that we haven't brought up. So stand by for Javier. Javier Machado, PW Torch contributor, welcome to the roundtable segment here. What's on your mind about Dynamite? How you doing?
Hey, wait, Brandon, how's it going?
Good, good. Good to hear from you.
I'm just tapping my feet over here to your intro.
Mike Myers did such a good job at that.
my top note was pretty much what you said, that Britt Baker cut one of the best babyface promos I've heard in a bit. She's definitely – I mean, I don't know how you can't call that a babyface promo. You know, explaining – I mean, it's like it should be used as a class to how to cut babyface promos. So I'm you know, and I kind of understand Soraya's, like, retort being like, you know what, let's just fight. Because, you know, I think it was kind of like, I don't think she meant to come across as she's here, the outsider, who's here to save AEW. Unfortunately, that's the way it did. And it seemed like whenever she tried to make it about something else, it kind of, you know, it her promos kind of veered into that territory. And it didn't help that Britt Baker is also, like, you know, feeding kind of into that. So, you know, I understand her, like, just throwing in the towel and says, okay, you know what, you know, I respect her, let's just fight.
And where do you think they're going? Do you think they looked at this? Do you think we would have seen what we saw this week if last week didn't happen? And I don't know how cognizant they are of what the criticism was, or if they just watched it play out and they're like, oh God, this isn't working. I just don't have a sense that they had a master plan that they're seeing through with an eye on what they want to do after this match. I mean, had Britt Baker not cut a promo that put herself over at Saraya's expense, and had Saraya cut back on the, hey, I really wanted to be in AEW. It was a cool place, but it's not as big of a deal as WWE, but maybe I can help it get close, even though we're not going to be at MSG anytime soon. Like, there just were some bad choices made last week in the promo by both women that should have been self-edited or edited by somebody else. And I think they got themselves into a kind of a no-win situation this week, but I'm not sure having Britt go totally babyface Javier was the move, because it should be a big deal when she goes babyface. I don't like this. It's like Seth Rollins just sort of becoming a babyface based on who's attacking him. That's like, that's less fun than having a moment where he has a choice and he makes a certain choice and the crowd pops and they go, finally, he's seen the light. He's siding with us. He got irritated with these irritating people just like we did. He had enough. He has certain standards that you know, he won't cross, and he was pushed to the limit, and now he's pushing back. None of that went on with Britt. It was just sort of like, oh, Saraya said some things that sounded arrogant, so now I'm going to rally AEW fans behind me. That's just not top dollar babyface turn booking.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that it was necessarily a good thing, but, you know.
Oh, right. No, yeah, definitely.
For what the story they're trying to tell and where she's currently at in her career, you know, but, I mean, the crowd likes her, and, I mean, maybe it might be time to just go ahead and start heading in that direction. You just use this as a way to show that Britt Baker, you know, has, you know, something honorable, something that you get behind, and then start pushing in that direction. You know, maybe have, you know, if they have a great match, Saraya and Britt, then, you know, maybe maybe it ends with them respecting each other at the end. And then, you know, down the road, they could team up against, like, another threat. So something like that could be a good direction for them to go. In terms of, like, the hater or babyface turn, I think that's what they're going for, but that really does feel like they jettisoned those plans once Saraya came in. And I could see, you know, I'm wondering if we actually end up with a Britt Baker babyface turn and a hater as a heel.
Will that work?
I don't know, that's what I'm
Brandon. Sorry, I got to throw to someone.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if that works or if they just end up cheering them both. I mean, the crowd very clearly wants to cheer Jamie Hayter. So just because Britt is now a babyface, I mean, will they boo Jamie Hayter if the crowd has yet to be given formal permission to cheer for Jamie Hayter? So are they going to just completely subvert that expectation if she attacks a newly minted babyface Britt Baker? I mean, that's the thing. Like, Jamie Hayter is already technically a heel, so she can't – she's a heel who the crowd desperately wants to cheer. So you didn't turn her, and theoretically, if she attacks a newly minted babyface Britt Baker, she isn't turning. So why would the crowd feel any differently? They still want to cheer her. This is the problem that you get into when you don't have clearly defined roles anymore.
Right. And you don't have somebody at overseeing everything who really has that is able to – I'm trying to think how to phrase this – is able to see what the more casual but valuable AEW viewer sees and what's going to – pull them in, but to do that without de-emphasizing anything that the core base loves about the product. And that is not, I don't think that's super difficult to do. I just say you don't want to be reckless about it, where you go, you know, aim for the casuals too much at the expense of the hardcores. The more ardent, hardcore, brand loyal, fervent fans are going to be there for you almost through thick and thin if you're stressing certain things that they look for, and you can concurrently do other things, but you need to have that person overlooking the whole product going, you know, if this person says this, this will be the reaction that will lead to a cascade effect, which might interrupt something that we were planning for before. Is it worth it to lose something we were planning in order to go with a flow of something that seems to be happening unexpectedly now? And then if it's unexpected and you can control it, then you can lean into it or steer away from it. And sure, with what happened last week with Baker and Soraya, what this week was supposed to be, but I also don't want to condemn it until I see what they do Saturday and next Wednesday as a follow-up. They might have decided we can't, you know, it's dumb having Baker be a tweener. Let's just, you know, have her be a face. And, you know, like you said, Javier, this is not ideal. It's not a great storyline, but they might have just decided we need them to kind of earn each other's respect. And, you know, they can be, you know, two people from two sides of the river with different backgrounds, earning each other's respect and then fighting some other battles together or apart. But if you take away the momentum of whatever Jamie Hayter had organically going for her, you're going against a headwind that had you planned better and had better foresight of what the reaction would be to certain other things, you might not have had to abandon or augment that. Brandon.
It certainly feels like they're cognizant of the situation that they were put in last week, because they could have chosen to just ignore what happened last week and tried to reframe and rewrite the narrative going into Saturday. Have Britt Baker cut, you know, a vicious heel promo and have Soraya respond with a fiery babyface promo. And because they're pre-tapes backstage, you know, you self-edit and you leave out the stuff that would be counterproductive to the roles that they're cast in. But they didn't do that. Instead, they leaned even harder into the direction that Britt Baker was a babyface, while also not sending any overt signals that they plan to turn Soraya heel, which, yeah, I mean, gives me the indication that maybe they're just going for, like you both have brought up, the respect route, which I don't think is the worst outcome here, given the predicament they're in.
Javier, your take.
Yeah, and they don't even taking a step back. It doesn't even need to be like them like becoming friends after that. They could still just not like each other, but respect each other, understand where they're coming from. And, you know, because I think that will do a lot of the damage that some of the, you know, the stuff that went awry. I think it'll help pull some of that back. And then you could keep, you know, Britt Baker as whatever she's doing, although I don't think that's the wisest course of action either. Choose one or the other and see where things land. And keeping with the women, the Jade and Nyla Rose thing is weird too, because, I slightly disagree with you, Brandon, because I think a babyface can do the thing where they steal the title and, you know, fit, you know, mock defend it, when the babyface is basically a trickster archetype. And while Nyla Rose does come across as that, like if you read her social media, that's not really the character that's portrayed on TV, which is why it's weird. Because, like, you know, and then at the same time, Jade, you know, Cargill, like, is like a no nonsense person, and like, but she doesn't really strike as, you know, she strikes more of like a badass. She comes across more as a badass, and you know, I mean, she may be a little bit, you know, like prickly, and that might turn some people off. But she doesn't really feel like she's full-blown, you know, a full-blown heel. So it's like, I don't know if I should, should I be angry at her? And then she's making a good point of, like, where's security? Why is security holding me back when I'm trying to get my property back? You know, stuff like that. It's like, you know, it's just like they're in a weird position. So for both women's matches, I can't wait for Full Gear to come and go to see, hopefully, that, you know, we arrive at some place.
Yeah, I don't like that feeling, which is things are a mess. I can't wait to get past the pay-per-view so things can get back on track. I do feel I've said that at this point before several AEW shows over the past couple of years, more often than not, maybe. And some of that is there's just been injuries and incidents, you know, that have messed things up. And I account for that, but I don't know. Yeah. Anyway. Oh, good. Yeah.
Especially when they've got so few of them. I mean, these should be loaded shows with really interesting dynamics. And a lot of times it just feels like they almost sort of forget that they have a pay-per-view coming up until about 2 weeks before the pay-per-view. And yeah. Then they're like, quick, throw 12 matches together.
Yes. Yep. I agree. Javier, what else have you got?
Yeah, and sticking with the women part, I think one of the reasons that the sure. Hater Toni Storm thing is cold is just that they're trying to tell us the story that, you know, these two had history and that Toni Storm is, like, hurt that her friend abandoned her. None of this played on TV. This is all stuff that you know, they're telling us that happened, and we haven't even seen a glimmer of this. So, like, you know, it's better than doing nothing, but at the same
right.
time, you're not going to really, like, have me engaged over having them fight. And, you know, when you do have people who are fans of Hayter who you know, are pulling for her and you have a cold champion, I think you end up another situation where you're going to have, well, I think more people are going to be behind Toni Storm. I think you're going to have, like, a sizable, loud contingent that's going to be, you know, on Hayter's side. So, again, another, like, kind of split. And that split, like, in a good way, because I know Todd Martin sometimes talks about that you know, that you know, you just choose who you want. But I think that really works when you have two people who are coming in with massive fan bases. So you get away with that
right.
because you're essentially putting the two massive fan bases together. I don't think that Toni Storm and Hayter, have that. And I think in that case, you kind of want to have, like, a good story where, you know, you can sink your teeth into the story because I don't think, you know, they have, like, the same kind of, like, you know, pull that other wrestlers have.
Yeah, I think not having clear-cut characters where you have a strong expected reaction that they each week amplify through their actions and words can lead to ambivalence. And, I mean, that might be what we're seeing both in AEW and WWE right now as people try this new age booking. We're not going to dumb it down to you're a good guy, you're a bad guy, and adhere to that. We're just going to let people go out there and wing it and let the crowd be into good matches. And I think that's being overdone right now. And I, again, maybe we need a larger sample size, but we do not have the red hot, and I think other things are at play too, but we do not have the red hot crowds in AEW that we once had. And boy, was that a competitive advantage early on. I mean, that was having just rabid crowds going absolutely bonkers for AEW's brand and their wrestlers was such a big plus that I think made up for some weak production values and sometimes I think overrated booking. And now I think they're paying a little bit more of a price for it. Javier, okay. Back to you. Oh, go ahead, then, Brandon. Yep.
Yeah, I just thought tonight in particular, the crowd stood out to me tonight more than even previous weeks for a go home show that featured basically all of the major stars that you have competing on Saturday at this big pay-per-view and for the vast majority of them to get just almost nothing. I mean, your biggest stars just getting smattering of cheers and respectful applause. I mean, that is not, that's not good.
No, it's not. Javier, what else is on your mind? I have some questions for you, but I'll let you get to your points too.
I want to see if I got this correct. Cause you know, the Excalibur drops a metric ton of information at once. So the winner of Archer and Starks is going to have to wrestle a second time against Cage, correct? On Rampage?
I did not pick up on that. Did you, Brandon? I thought they were just saying...
That is how I interpreted it, only because they are saying that the finals is taking place at Full Gear, which means unless they are putting a semifinal match on the show itself, which not only would not make sense from a length perspective, but also from a fairness perspective, if one of your finalists has already been determined, then yeah, they have to do both Rampage.
Because Starks wasn't medically cleared because of the angle with Archer.
Right.
So they are squeezed. Yeah. I did not pick up on that being established, but I wasn't even thinking about the time crunch and needing the finals at the pay-per-view. You're kind of, as you said, Brandon, it's not going to be fair either way. You just have to decide which night is unfair.
Right. Which begs the question, like, why not just do it tonight then? Why not do Archer and Starks tonight?
Yeah. Yeah. True. Javier, so you brought that up. Did you have more to say about that?
Well, yeah, because that, you know, so now I'm painting the picture for Winter's Coming. That kind of makes me feel like that Winter's Coming is either going to be Moxley and Ethan Page or Starks versus MJF. What do you think is the more attractive? And the thing is, the interesting about the Starks is that Starks would then have to beat both Lance Archer and Brian Cage on the same night, and then the following night defeat Ethan Page. You know, so that would be like a big feather in his cap, having, you know, three tough fights, you know, in 2 days, and build up on that. Plus, you know, he's a great promo. So I like that idea if MJF wins and stays heel. Or do you think the other way? What do you think is the more likely Winter's Coming scenario?
I think Mox and Ethan Page is the match they've done a better job building up. If MJF goes heel to win the title, and Starks is his first challenger, people like Starks, and that works. If MJF goes babyface coming out of the match and takes on Starks, I don't like that, because you should just feed a newly turned babyface champion heels. Although they can also just turn Starks again. You know, why not? More turns, the better. What did you imagine when you brought that up, Javier? And then go ahead, Brandon, after that.
Well, I was thinking that Starks makes a nice story in terms of, like, you know, overcoming that. Although you could also just tell that the reason he can't overcome Page is because of the previous night's beatdown, and then have that be like his what builds him up, and then Ethan Page has like a clear sailing. Because that's the other possibility is babyface MJF versus the heel Ethan Page. It almost feels like the pieces have been placed because they haven't made a decision yet. Because, I mean, you could go multiple ways.
I am worried that that's possible. That they're still trying to figure out what they want to do, and second guessing. Because whatever they do, they're going to leave some other things behind. You know, I mean, they have to choose a path, and both, you know, all the paths are tempting in different ways. Some might be more difficult than others, but if they pull them off, might work out better. So, I don't know. I mean, I'm not quite to the predictions part of this conversation, Brandon, in terms of what do you think will happen to Moxley and MJF in that match. But as far as the tournament goes, any additional thoughts?
I like the Ethan Page direction better overall, because I think that you have a built-in story for either guy with Ethan Page. Page is associated with the firm, Stokely Hathaway. So he is already indirectly feuding with both Jon Moxley and MJF. So you have a story to tell either way there. I think that if Moxley wins, you have the clear babyface Moxley against clear heel Ethan Page. If you go the other direction, you could have babyface MJF versus heel Ethan Page. Or if for some reason MJF goes heel, whether it be with Regal, then, you know, I don't think you have a significant issue there, because MJF is going to get cheered. Even if he turns heel, he's already technically a heel. I mean, he's going to continue to be cheered, especially against Ethan Page. And then I think you can at least tell a decent and interesting story on television if there is a situation where MJF is facing a fellow member of the firm and Stokely Hathaway has to get involved and make a decision one way or the other. So I think there's just more options, more stories to tell with Ethan Page. I also like how they've handled Ethan Page in the last few weeks. I think it's been one of the more consistent things that they've done. For Ricky Starks, I also think losing that final match does good for him in the long run, because I do think, you know, it should be him in the finals. So he beats Lance Archer and then beats Brian Cage on Rampage. It's a big crowning moment. You know, he gets this victory over two guys that he's giving up substantial size to. He goes into the match with Ethan Page hurt. He puts up a valiant effort. Page wins in the end. You continue telling the story of Starks, you know, trying to overcome the odds and rise up the card.
Javier, back to you.
And I also want to give props to Ethan Page that the crowd was dead when he came out and he picked up the mic and he like said, you know, hey, you're going to pay attention to me. You know, just commanded them to do that. So I, you know, I definitely give him props for that. So because he knows what, you know, to draw attention when he's the center, when he needs to be the center of attention. I did like the Moxley promo much better than the previous one because I thought the previous one kind of veered too much into him essentially saying you're a gimmick wrestler, while this one I think it worked what he wanted to say without actually saying hey you're just a gimmick wrestler. So I like this one a lot better. I have a small concern, and this is, you know, this is a subjective thing on my end, you know, small concern because it really does feel like they kind of don't mesh because Moxley feels so authentic that MJF, no matter how good he is putting on that act, kind of like in comparison feels like he's putting on an act for me. I don't know if it feels the same way for you guys, but it feels like gimmick wrestler against, you know, like a real person. I don't know if you guys feel the same way, but that's kind of how I feel about it.
Brendan, what do you think about that? And also,
and that's the point where I'm like, you know, oh, I don't like this, but you know, it is something that is telling when these two are like in the same ring.
And so, yeah, your thoughts on that, Brendan, and kind of what Javier said early on in that question about the topic about the promo last week from Moxley and this week, and last week kind of undressing MJF's gimmick and framing it as an inauthentic gimmick. And if that did damage compared to this week, which, yeah, I mean, I definitely like this week's better. But so much of when I evaluate these, I'm like, I don't know what the payoff is. I don't know where they're going.
Right.
So maybe some of the things they're doing only will make sense and feel justified once we see what the result of the match is and what they do the next week on Dynamite. So, you know, I hedge a little on coming down too hard on it because I do think it's presumptuous to come down totally against something if you don't actually know what they have in mind, but you just think you know what they have in mind. That said, I don't know how what happened last week helps unless it was trying to lay the foundation for fans to accept Moxley as a babyface and MJF as a heel by mocking MJF in an effective way as being sort of a phony and his mom dresses him and that kind of thing. But then this week seemed to pull back on that. So that would play into the theory they're going back and forth on what they actually want to do on Saturday, perhaps.
Yeah, I don't get the same sense that Javier does as far as MJF goes. I think that his consistency outside of the ring, granted, he's such an in your face loud character that you look at someone like that and yes, if you give it thought for a few moments, you figure like someone like this can't exist. I liken MJF to my girlfriend has dragged me into watching the Bachelor franchise, and I very much dislike the main show, but boy, do I have a ton of fun with Bachelor in Paradise. And there are people that come on the beach in that show, and I watch them talk and give a couple interviews, and I say, this person is not real. Like, they are a character. They are they have been told to act this way because a real person doesn't act like that. They just don't. And there is definitely some of that with MJF. But I think he's so consistent with it that I give him a pass because there is no interview, at least one that I have found, where MJF is anything or anyone but MJF.
Yeah.
So it still works for me in that regard, but it is definitely a character that is over the top. As far as Moxley's promo goes, yes, I thought tonight was better than last week. I still thought that there was a certain amount of dressing down of Friedman, and I wonder how much of that is trying to set the stage or paint the picture that Moxley is taking MJF lightly. You saw WWE try to tell that story to mostly to success with Logan Paul, that yes, Logan Paul is not a legitimate challenger for Roman Reigns, but Roman Reigns is a little off his game and maybe he's not taking him seriously enough. And maybe Logan Paul could pull one over on him. I don't think that they're going quite as heavy-handed in that direction, because clearly MJF is a formidable wrestler who has proven himself against other formidable opponents, including CM Punk, who, you know, has had long matches with Jon Moxley. But I do think that there is some of that. Some of the, you know, Moxley is this tried and true wrestler's wrestler who loves to fight, and MJF is really the antithesis of that. He is the guy who wants all the guts, wants all the glory, or wants all the glory, but doesn't really want to put his guts on the line. And I think that they're leaning into that a little bit, and that is why you've seen Moxley say some of the things that he said. I don't know if it's the best way to tell this story, especially when there is so little clarity in terms of who I'm supposed to root for.
So, Brandon, who wins on Saturday between Moxley and MJF? Or Friedman, as you call him. I was like, who's he talking about? Who's Friedman? It's either MJF or Max. I was like, who's Friedman? It's like, oh, weird. His last name's Friedman. I've never thought of him as Friedman. That's just so weird. Anyway.
I mean, it actually felt a little weird when I said it. I wanted to break...
It's like when you hear the first name of one of your school teachers back in the day. You're like,
yeah. Well, I had said MJF several times in the same sentence, so I was like, I'm going to break that up. And normal speak with a wrestler, I'm going to call them their last name. So that's what I did. And then it came out, and I was like, oh, man, yeah. So if you had asked me this before tonight, I think I would have said MJF. It just felt like it was the time to do it. And I guess I still sort of lean in that direction, but I'm less confident about it now.
Javier, prediction.
I'm leaning to MJF with Regal's help, particularly since he said, I'm not going to use the dynamite ring, right? Right, Will? And, you know, that could, on retrospect, be like him, you know, not like being sarcastic to Regal, but more being like, that's what we agreed on, right, Regal? And I think that also adds, and I think that it also ties into the other stuff that's going on with the Blackpool Combat Club with the strife between Danielson and Wheeler Yuta and what's going on there. I can see a betrayal and Moxley go on his long postponed vacation, leaving Danielson out on the cold with probably Claudio and Yuta staying with Regal and being the faction that MJF has.
I think the most compelling reason that MJF it's a good bet that MJF wins the title is Moxley skipped his vacation and might want to go on that. I mean, I feel like if I answer this my own question, I will in tomorrow give a different answer and not realize it, because I bounce back and forth on this so much. I wrote the cover story in the newsletter, and I was like, I don't even know as I'm writing this out. Like, I thought, well, if I kind of, you know, write about it, I'll come to some, oh, this is the logical way things have been pointing. It's a good call. It makes sense. And other than Moxley turning heel, I don't, you know, and winning or losing a belt, I don't think that's going to happen. But MJF winning the title as a face, winning the title as a heel, or losing as a face, or losing as a heel, all feel possible. And I'm not even saying that's a good or bad thing. I think they have all the options at their disposal. I hope that there is a plan, and even what they did with Daniel Garcia a couple months ago, what felt like a sharp turn away from where they were heading. Maybe they always plan it that way. I'd be critical of that if that's the case. I'm critical of it if it wasn't and they made the choice they made, but maybe that will all kind of play fit into something. But if Mox is going to be gone for a while and they need a top baby face, then, you know, it makes sense to go with MJF. I just think MJF should be a heel longer and the chase should be longer for if he turns face. Even if he turns face this weekend, the chase to win the title should be longer. I think that's giving away a little bit too much too soon for him. But I also acknowledge the headwind of trying to get people to boo him. And so I don't know. I just don't know. I'm bracing to be disappointed with the choice they made or underwhelmed, but I'm also bracing for the possibility it just works and it's great. And that could, I don't know how MJF turns heel and it works great. But I in the long run kind of prefer MJF to be a heel if they can pull it off and get him booed. But he's got to stop talking about how much he loves pro wrestling and wants, you know, and get inspiring fans to cheer him. He's got to study the promos where fans who are booing him start cheering him and cut that part out of his promos and cut that out of his character. So yeah, I'd rather see MJF as a heel for another year, but right now the fans have been cheering him. This was a dead crowd, hard to judge. And do you organic baby faces who just, you know, come up like this, you know, going way back, WCW had that with Rick Steiner. Fans were just starting to cheer him like crazy. Circa 89, 90, and they could have, you know, spruced things up with him with a world title run, and they just didn't do it because they didn't see him in that role. They didn't think that was the right time or the right person, but the fans were really behind him. And those things happen now and then, and, you know, sometimes you regret not seizing it and trying to micro-plan it. So I don't know. I ask you because I'm hoping to be swayed, and I'm not really swayed. Javier, what else have you got?
Yeah, I had to go back and look at the primer that I'm writing that to see what my decision was, because I could have given you a different answer too.
Yeah, I know that's it's fascinating. Yeah.
The other thing is the, well, first I mentioned the match. Happy to see AR Fox. I liked him a lot when I watched Evolve, and I liked him when he was on Lucha Underground. They mentioned that he was a trainer, and for people who don't know, one of the names that's big right now is he helped train Austin Theory. So he was part of his faction, and then they had a pretty good program on Evolve. The announcement of the Elite coming back was not really the way I expected it. I was expecting a little bit more, flash and pizzazz or something.
Yep.
Not just, you know, they're burning out of all their image is being burnt out of AEW, and then they get burnt back in, and it was just like, just weird. I'm halfway wondering if they weren't going to announce them showing up and then decided to add that in the last minute, to try to get more buys.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. I could see that being the case, which it's unfortunate that they don't feel strongly enough in the car that they have, and you think this is going to generate additional interest, but man, I mean, it's a match they've done before. Not to say that it's not going to be really good. It is, but like, it's one of my chief complaints with AEW, the loading up of these cards to the point that it just feels like a marathon and absolutely nothing has room to breathe. So absolutely nothing feels important.
Yeah. Yeah. if you said, oh, the Elite are going to be off television in between All Out and Full Gear, and this is the master storyline that they have planned, I mean, there's better things you can do. I mean, it just comes down to, you know, they're EVPs, they've been gone, we're not going to talk about why they were gone, and they're going to come back, and the first chance to see them is on pay-per-view. Like, that, I don't even think that's a huge draw. Like, I think you have to talk people into thinking it's a big deal. And that crowd reaction of Pac inning at the Elite and the Elite chant not starting, even though someone tried, is not a good sign. It's just not a good sign. I mean, I'm sure they'll get a good reaction on Saturday night, but the idea of we got stripped of the tag titles and now we're coming back for them, and Pac is saying, yeah, you've been hinting but not being direct with me, and then suddenly a graphic appears and he goes, finally, you're being direct with me. That's not an angle.
It just the whole thing has felt really lazy. And I wonder if there's some hesitancy on the part of Tony Khan and AEW, or if he's even self aware that like the public backlash and reception to the way that everything went down with that media scrum, I don't necessarily think everyone feels that way, but for me personally, like, the fallout of that, everything that happened surrounding that, made me less excited about seeing the parties involved. And I just don't feel like there has been this groundswell for the elite to return to TV. And I feel the same way on the other side. Like, I don't feel like there's been a groundswell for CM Punk to come back anytime soon. I think that everyone in that involved in that scenario rubbed people the wrong way. And that's not to say that the elite won't be cheered again and that they can't be big stars. I just think that there's some hesitancy. There isn't that pent-up excitement because they weren't gone because of injury. It's not like Kenny Omega coming back from this long hiatus because he was hurt. I mean, they're coming back from a highly publicized but never spoken about suspension that everyone is privy to the details of.
Javier?
Well, I mean, not Pat, because he actually kind of hinted at, you know, everything being, you know, hush-hush during the promo, that, you know,
yeah.
Oh, we finally get some transparency. That was the word. We finally have some transparency. That was the word used.
Yeah.
So.
Yes.
But yeah, I mean, I'm just looking forward to see, like, the reaction, because I'm wondering, because it feels like there's almost like a fan base within a fan base when it comes to AEW, where there's the AEW fan base and then there's the AEW elite fan base, and, you know, like a sub-faction kind of thing. And I'm curious if they're, like, if they got frustrated and left. That's kind of my thing. Cause I'm very curious to see the reaction they get at the show.
Yeah, I am too. there might come a point where everybody needs to step back and go, you know, do we have to up our game a little bit in terms of, or change our game in terms of kind of how we're doing this? I think, Javier, what did you think of that email before you came on about AEW featuring in prominent positions a lot of people who worked on the indie scene and approached things differently than people who worked, you know, as part of a weekly ongoing TV series?
I like the perspective the person brought up, that they go from territory to territory, so they just have to do the one thing that they're good at. And I do think that might be an issue where they don't know how to craft a long-term storyline, because when you're moving around the indies, that's good for you to build your character, but you're not building stories. That's why, like, when you watch, you know, at least when I watch WWE, it feels like it's more heavy, in a lot of cases, more heavier story-based than it's character-based. You know, I mean, you do have your strong characters, but a lot of times it's the story that's what's driving things, not the character interactions. In the indies, it's the character interactions, because you, like, you know, I mean, Joe Hendry, for example, I've been catching up on Impact. He's got this gimmick and he's got this thing, and he's that thing wherever he goes. I hate bringing him up. I mean, at least not as bad as bringing up Hitler, but Marty Scurll, the whole villain gimmick, can you do that, like, constantly on a show? A better example would be Orange Cassidy with his, you know, his lackadaisical thing. Like, when he's going through the indies and you're only watching him in that one show, you're like, oh, this is a cool character, and you'll go see him whenever he comes by again. But when you're telling, like, a weekly story, it is hard to have one of those characters. And I do think that some wrestlers, if they don't have that long-term storytelling, bone and understanding, I think that might, like, explain some of the stuff when it comes to the way that AEW tells stories, that they don't have that, you know, they don't get involved in stuff where it's going to change their character when you're on TV week to week.
Yeah. Yep. That makes sense.
Is that a failure of the company to not steer them in the right direction, or does the company not have the bodies to steer them in the right direction? In other words, like, you think about, like, NXT. NXT is notorious for bringing in a ton of indie guys who have then turned out to be, you know, successful wrestlers under both the WWE umbrella, the main roster umbrella, as well as later on AEW. And when you're brought into NXT, everything you know is basically thrown out the window, and you're told to sort of abandon everything but your instincts and adhere to this strict guideline and this mold that WWE has perpetuated. And AEW doesn't have that, but now 3 years in of that experiment, I think we're kind of finding that sometimes that mold works and it benefits a lot of wrestlers. So is it the fault of Tony Khan and AEW for not bringing in trainer types like NXT has, like non-wrestlers who can guide talent in the right direction? Or, you know, should we be putting some of the blame on the talent who are wrestling full-time but are also coaches in a way? Like, Chris Jericho knows how to make this work. Like, Chris Jericho knows how to take a character and turn it into something that works on weekly episodic television. Jon Moxley obviously knows. I mean, Saraya, now that she's there, I mean, she has a good idea. Bryan Danielson, Claudio, the list goes on. I mean, these are guys that have been in that system and been in multiple systems where they've had plenty of success having a character that needs to expand and grow and learn week to week instead of just being a character who does his thing and moves on to the next town.
I think there should be someone with an eye towards the fact that AEW is a weekly show. Which is what it feels like it's missing, and you're right. It feels like Jericho's kind of like, because the Jericho and the people around Jericho are generally like well off for the most part, and the people that he's interested in. So I'm wondering if it's just that, you know, these are the coaches who get these groups of people together, and at the same time, you know, is a conflict of visions, because I'm pretty sure that the vision of Jericho is going to be different from Moxley, who are the two that have been, you know, kind of like pseudo-promoted kind of way. Not that they're necessarily in conflict with each other, but it is, you know, a different thing. I think there needs to be – ultimately what it feels like is a lack of communication, really. I think it's ultimately what yeah. It's at, where it feels like everyone – and it was really obvious during the Cody – when Cody was there, because we, you know, just say you got the Cody-verse, and then you also had the Elite-verse, where everybody was kind of like on their own thing. But they all had – they all had like positives and negatives, like what the Elite do with being the Elite, you know, the way they would tell, you know, like these melodramatic, like soap opera esque storylines, that attracted a lot of people. So that was a bonus. I mean, yeah, you know, the haha and the clubhousey feel, way that, you know, that is a negative for a lot of people, but there's no reason why they couldn't really like, you know, come together and say, okay, this what works, what you do, this is what you work, you know, what you do works. And it feels like more like everyone's siloed by themselves as opposed to them like working together. But you know, it's a question of like, is there one vision, you know? And I think that Tony Khan likes to book matches. So as long as the matches are getting done, you know,
yep.
You know, cause you know, I mean, the coolest thing, I mean, really, I think one of the coolest things for me is the Takeshita match with Eddie Kingston and, you know, the match that I have, and that has, like, nothing to do with what's going on. You know, it has nothing to do with Full Gear. And it's just, like, it's a neat thing. And it's, you know, and I think that really, and, you know, a lot of people soured on things during the Forbidden Door stuff. And I'm beginning to see why, because it was, like, that was, like, a kid in the candy shop. Oh, I want to see this matchup. I want to see this matchup. I want to see this matchup without it actually really building anything. if AEW were an indie, that would be awesome. But it's not an indie. It's a weekly show.
I was just going to say, like, Tony Khan is an indie promoter with money. I mean, really, like, he just
– yeah.
Like, with these indie shows, they often try very hard to have storylines, and they try their best, but they can't because talent isn't available month to month. Like, they may be across the country and they can't fly them out or what have you, or maybe they sign somewhere. Tony operates much in that capacity, even though he has, you know, 150, 200 something wrestlers under contract, he still goes out and flies in free agents for matches because it's a cool match. Like, he's an indie promoter with an unlimited budget, essentially.
Yeah. Well put. Javier, anything else you want to bring up from the show? I took you first, but I do want to get to a couple callers too, and we're running along. I'm not rushing you, but don't feel like you have to fill time either with us.
Yeah. Okay. So that was the question you had for me?
Oh, I was going to ask about the indie thing. So I did get to that. I think that was the main other topic. By the way, do you have anything you want to bring up, Brandon, that we haven't yet with Javier on the line before we move on? And I'll think if there's something else I wanted to bring up too.
The acclaimed music video.
Yeah, that's what I was just looking. I wanted to get your thoughts on that. Javier, you first.
Well, it's silly. It's fun. I have no problem with it. I can't really analyze it because it was just, you know, stupid fun. So
yeah,
you know, what is it good for business? I don't know. That's like an Eric Kroll question. Who's always like, you know, he is a good for business guy. So I found it fun. So I'm not going to
blame. I did too. Find it fun. You know, I think people who don't like it have to understand it's some people coming who are from a different generation, probably. Although you can be 30 years old or 25 and not like it too. I mean, obviously, teach their own. But
yeah.
I thought they did a nice job with it. It was playful. It was, you know, it's just kind of TikTok generation type thing, and it fits their characters. It seems like something that they would do in their spare time.
Yeah, I don't love this level of comedy being applied to the tag team titles, but as a caveat to that, earlier on I was complaining about the fact that, you know, Saraya and Britt Baker is clearly the biggest storyline in the women's division when Toni Storm has the title and feels like an undercard act. So though I typically don't like that much comedy in a serious title picture, I also have to acknowledge that without question, the Acclaimed are the most overact in the tag team division and therefore should probably be around the tag team titles right now. So, I found it entertaining for what it was, and I sort of have to stipulate to the fact that I wish that the tag title picture was more serious, but I also think that it's a conundrum for the company to be in, but I think ultimately the right move is to have them in that title picture, given that right now they're the hottest act on the show, for better or for worse.
right, yep. Anything else, Javier?
Well, just wanted to bring up one thing on the on the email that they mentioned, that, you know, why is it that babyfaces wrestle like 2 days before the match? the thing is that babyfaces, and this is a general storyline, you know, storytelling in general, the good guys are honorable. One of the definitions for honorable is that they have a sense of duty. And a wrestler's duty is to wrestle. So the baby face is the person who will, even though they have a match coming up, they're going to go out and wrestle in front of a paying audience, and also to test themselves, because that's like what their job is. While the heel, you know, who is unprincipled, does not do the same thing because he'd rather take the easy route and have things easier. And if you notice, like most time, with few exceptions, because, you know, there are exceptions to the rule, you know, if the babyface is going to have the match, whether he's the champion or not, they're usually the one wrestling, you know, more soon to the actual big match, because, you know, that's what the good guys do. And, you know, while yes, it's more expedient to be rested, this is, good guy, you know, the honorable thing to do is to, you know, honor your commitments to an audience. So that's kind of why you usually would see that why baby faces will take on challenges when it might not be to the best of, you know, what you would consider practical, you know, scenario.
Brandon.
I just wanted to, I was just looking, I certainly agree with Javier, but I just happened to see, on Twitter a short time ago, MJF cut a very, very, full blown babyface promo where Tony Khan was in the ring and he put over Tony Khan and said that without him and without AEW, wrestling would be a monopoly. So, I mean, I don't know if it was just a for the crowd thing, but he's going heavy handed on the babyface shtick.
Interesting. What happens off air doesn't always count in the canon, but it should.
Yeah. I mean, it's also, it's just an interesting dynamic because, you know, you had the supposed tension between MJF and Tony Khan. And so people are rightfully saying, you know, did he sign a new deal? Like, is that the confirmation or is he just getting paid a whole lot of money for these dates?
Yeah, exactly. All right, cool. Javier, any closing words or final quick topics?
That's it. Just be on the lookout for the primer. I think there are 12 or 11 matches already announced. I'm still waiting for the next four to be announced because we know there are 15 matches on this card. So
The sooner you get the article in, the more that people will read it. I wouldn't hold off waiting for a last second announcement because, you know, it's going to take a long time to read a preview to 12 matches. You don't want that just posted, you know, 4 hours before the show.
Yeah.
When they add four by 7 o'clock.
Yeah, there's just no way to avoid that.
Have they announced, buy-in matches yet? Because there's plenty of those coming.
I don't think they have.
Yeah, I haven't.
I'm pretty sure Hook and Lee Shoddy is probably going to be one of them.
Okay. Yeah. Somebody emailed and said Lee's punches on Moxley were really bad in the ring, and I went back and watched, and yeah, they were.
I picked up on that.
Yep.
So I'll finish it up and send it.
Awesome. Cool. Thanks, Javier. Cool. Always good talking to you.
All right. Have a good one. Good night, I guess.
Yep, you too. Okay, so let's Brandon, you cool with sticking around for a couple calls here and maybe one more email? Okay. So Ashley in Virginia has been on hold for a little while. Let's get to Ashley. Thanks for calling. What's in your mind about Dynamite tonight? Good to hear from you. Ashley, are you there? Did you intend to push one? Oh, there you are. Yeah, we can hear you now, Ashley.
Hey, so sorry about that. I muted myself. Sorry about that.
Oh, no problem. So, that's why we wait. It can happen.
Thank you so much. It's very cool to talk to you guys. And thank you for taking the call. I know it's late. I was just catching up on Dynamite. I haven't finished the whole thing, but and I know you guys went in depth about Saraya and Paige, Saraya and Britt Baker, but I agree with you guys completely. I haven't seen Saraya's part yet, but the direction that Dr. Britt Baker went in with her promo, if that's not a babyface promo, I don't really know what else would be. So I'm very intrigued to see just how they handled the match at Full Gear. And I forget who mentioned it. I can kind of see the direction if they take it where they do a mutual respect. They may not be best friends, but have a mutual respect. But I'm really interested to see too, the direction for Saraya after Full Gear. I mean, don't want to plan anything too far in advance because number one thing is making sure she's okay after this match and kind of taking it, I guess match by match. But I'm just really intrigued. Do you think she's going to go for the interim, women's championship or the TBS championship? Do you think they just hold off on that altogether? Or where really does she go? Because I feel like when you start with essentially the face of especially the women's division for AEW, whether or not she beats Britt Baker or not, you really have to go to a championship, especially if you beat Britt. So where do you guys, and if you mentioned that already, I'm so sorry, but where do you really see Saraya going after that all health, staying positive and everything like that?
Brandon.
Yeah, definitely to expand upon what you said about Britt Baker's promo. She hit all of the notes of a full-fledged babyface. I mean, playing to the crowd and sort of intimating that she has had their support all this time, that they shared a special bond because of the matches, in Daly's place and how she was there and how she was entertaining the fans and that she's an AEW original and she worked her way up from the bottom. I mean, yeah, she hit every single note of a token babyface. And I think that in order to undo that, I mean, you're going to have to do a whole lot of cleanup that isn't going to sound well, come off well, or really work in the long run. So I think they have to commit at this point. As far as after the match between these two, regardless of how it ends up, I think that you have to look to move one or both of them into the title picture before too long. I expect Toni Storm to come out of Full Gear champion, though. I mean, who knows? Maybe if they're generally unimpressed with the reactions, maybe they want to move to Jamie Hayter to set something up with Britt Baker. I don't know. There are a lot of options there, but I do think it's going to be key and very important to move Saraya and Britt to the title picture pretty quickly, because they are the two most important women in the division right now. And I think that it's hard to see either of them matching up with many other people without it feeling like a significant downgrade.
Ashley, what else?
Really quick, it's kind of bizarre. Just we get no mention of Thunder Rosa, like how she's doing. I feel like it's in AEW, I don't know if they view it as like a negative thing that, you know, like to speak about when someone gets injured, but like, it's just thinking about the Hangman Page thing, for instance, as well. Unless I missed something, like we haven't heard, like, on Dynamite, at least, any update on him, like just making sure he's okay. You know, like I don't need a full medical history, just making sure like he's okay and Thunder Rosa's okay. Like, she technically is still the women's champion, but they just never speak about her. So it's just kind of bizarre to me. Yeah. But I will let you guys go. Thank you so much for taking the call. I don't want to keep you guys too long, but thank you as always. And shout out to Zach Cador and Tyler Sage. I really enjoy their YouTube channel and everyone who chimes in on there, Sean and everyone like that. So thank you guys so much for all the content. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Ashley. Yes, everybody, check out the PW Torch YouTube channel. Search PW Torch or go to youtube.com/PW Torch. Ashley, always great hearing from you. And I wasn't not answering your question, but I did talk at length earlier about the two promos. So you can go back and listen to that, but I didn't want Brandon to respond directly to what you said. As for the health updates and the update of the champion who's not active, yeah, I mean, I'm all for that. I think that the lack of Hangman Page updates is weird, and it feels sort of disrespectful to the fans and to him. I don't care if you don't have a storyline worked out. Just the last time we saw him, the match was stopped in the middle, and this assumption, people just look it up online. I just don't think that should be an assumption, and I don't think people who watch Dynamite should have homework to find out about one of their major characters. No TV series does that. Thunder Rosa, I don't know how they feel about her. You know, if they want to build her up and hype her while she's out, or if they don't have a good solid timeline, or they think, let's get past this pay-per-view and then past the ROH pay-per-view, and then we'll start dedicating TV time to somebody who isn't going to, you know, be able to show up and start paying off that investment with matches and promos. At some point, I would like them to acknowledge her and update her comeback, and it should be more than the show she appears on. You know, like, get us into the... tell us about the journey, her comeback journey, and what she's been going through, if you want her return to mean the most. Brandon, your thoughts?
Yeah, Thunder Rosa is one in a long line of people who are frequently forgotten. And for her, it may be for a bit different reasons. I know that there was some murmurs and mumblings of discontent with her, and certainly she has been, you know, sort of visibly frustrated at times on social media, and there's been some tweets directed her way as well from other talent. So I don't know if that's another situation where they're letting things cool off, if it falls in the FTR category. I mean, beyond the injury, of course, but this has been a habit of AEW, and it extends beyond talent that's on the shelf with injury. Like, you know, Hangman Page, Adam Cole, those guys are off TV because of injury, but we still don't hear about them. But then there's a long line of other guys who just disappear from TV for months on end without any mention. And it's consistent, and it's been happening for a long time. I don't really understand it. I mean, there's a lot of talent under contract, and so many of them have not appeared in months while they continue to sign new talent and bring in talent on one-off appearances. And it makes it hard to know what you're getting into on a week-to-week basis. Not to say that there shouldn't be a rotation of talent. I think that's very important, and I would love to see even, you know, like WWE do more of that. But it's the inconsistency that I think is so frustrating. I would rather have someone like Miro come in and be heavily featured for a three-month stint and then be off TV for 3 months than I would say see him the first week of September and then the last week in November with no explanation as to where he was in between.
Totally agree. All right, cool. Let's go to Bryant in Boston next. Bryant, thanks for calling. What's on your mind about Dynamite tonight?
Yeah, just to kind of echo your guys' points about AEW's consistency and lack of transparency. I mean, I know they're a private company and they have the right to do that, but, you know, it's not a good look to your fan base if you're just staying bum about injuries and not even just mentioning things. I mean, Thunder Rosa, I mean, she's been keeping, like, people who follow her, like, on Instagram and YouTube and stuff, apprised of her progress. So I don't know why Tony Khan just can't in a busted open interview, like, say, you know, what's going on with Miro, or, you know, just update someone on an injury. And I think, and I hate to say this, but I think he's in over his head. And he, you know, part of the, like, 90% of the problem, 90% of that way to helping out with a problem is to admit you have one. And I don't think he's willing to do that until he does. You know, I mean, the shows are still good, but he needs to admit that he has an issue and he needs help. That's just part of my thought on it. Just wondering what you guys think.
Brandon, I mean, Bryant is kind of summing up some of our critiques into sort of a broader, simple explanation. Is it a fair characterization?
Yeah, I don't think it's entirely unreasonable. I mean, Tony Khan is a likable, affable personality, and I think that he gets a break from a lot of people for his media availability and his general demeanor and appreciation for the fans, and especially for wrestling media. He presents himself in a way that is very much a complete antithesis of the way that WWE operates. And in a lot of ways, I think that's a good thing. But I also think that it sometimes shields him from some really genuine criticism that is not coming from a place of malice, but rather from voices who want the show to be really good and think that Tony Khan can probably be a competent promoter. He just, you know, like you mentioned, Brian, like, he might need a little help. He might need some outside help, some other creative minds. And you know, Vince McMahon was a one-man show in a lot of ways, but he had a lot of people in his ear too. And yes, they were often just telling him what he wanted to hear, but there is very much a large gathering of creative minds within WWE. And even if they're only answering to one person, they are bringing ideas that I'm sure Vince is at times poaching, or when he was, you know, in the company. With Tony, it almost feels like we kind of talked about earlier. He's just booking matches and having loosely followed plot lines from week to week. And I just don't. I think that works really well if you're an indie promoter, but not if you're doing 3 hours of television a week.
But I think it's also worth pointing out that Vince McMahon, you know, didn't overstretch himself. I mean, I mean, he overstretched himself, you know, working himself to the bone, but he only had like one primary company to focus on. Tony Khan has a lot of different things to focus on besides AEW, so I think that comes into play as well.
I don't think it would be, I don't want to soften the language. I think it would be good for Tony to find somebody who brings something to his week-to-week, day-to-day approach to booking, who has a different perspective that would complement where his strengths are and build on those, but bring something other than the, you know, great match booking. You know, booking great match is sort of the centerpiece, and add some. Yeah, I mean, all the things we're talking about. I don't need to recap it all. I mean,
you look at Hollywood shows, especially long running shows with intricate plots. Like they have, usually on these big shows, they will have an entire department or a team whose sole purpose is to edit for consistency. So they are the ones who are studying scripts and sitting in on creative meetings for episodes of TV, and their sole purpose is essentially to make sure that they're not leaving dangling threads and plot holes. Even something that simple in the AEW creative room, I think would be big, because Tony Khan is not giving up power in that scenario. He is still in full control of writing the week-to-week TV and putting together his show. All that he would have in that situation is a person in his ear who says, hey, we had this thread left over from last week. Do you want to follow it up on Dynamite or on Rampage? And hey, this story, we've been telling this story for X number of weeks. Do we want to continue that thread? Do we want to set a hard date on when we want to close it, when we want to move, when we want to transition to something new? Even something as simple as that, I think, would help his vision have better focus.
Brian, what do you think?
Yeah, I think in the end, delegation is kind of the word of the day. You know, obviously, you know, he should be in charge of the general sense, but he also needs, I mean, he badly needs someone to maintain discipline in the locker room. I mean, you know, when you get talent sniping at each other on Twitter all the time and things like that, I mean, you don't see, I mean, I'm not saying talent shouldn't be able to express themselves in further feuds, but further like storyline feuds on Twitter and stuff, but you know, you know, you don't see WWE wrestlers going off the script, so to speak, on social media like some AEW guys do. So I think Braun Strowman's always had that issue. He's kind of like a right wing nut job. But anyway, all right, I won't keep you guys too much longer. Overall, I thought the show was pretty good. I thought the Ethan Page-Bandito match was a little clunky. There was one spot that was really weird to me, like when right before Stokely Hathaway tripped Bandito's leg, Ethan Page had just Irish whipped him, and he was going to follow up the attack, but for some reason Bryce Remsburg got in his way on purpose. It's like, what was that? I don't know if you guys noticed that part at all.
You pick up on that, Brandon?
No, I didn't catch it.
Yeah, I didn't either. Now I want to go back and look for it.
Yeah,
it was. There were some clunky spots in that match, and I don't know, maybe it was the clash of styles or something. And also, I thought the ending part where MJF just single-handedly beat the firm up was kind of that wasn't very logical, to be honest. They could have done without the firm part, to be honest, or you know, at least in that case, bring out the Blackpool Combat Club, so at least it makes it look a little bit more realistic. But just to kind of close off on the women, I thought Toni Storm, Jamie Hayter was great, and just to kind of follow up on Ashley's point about either Baker or Hayter going for the champion, I think the obvious champion you need to go for is Jade Cargill, because her let's be honest. I mean, she's got all the potential in the world, but her reign is like a wet fart right now. Cue the Sean Spears joke. But I think what they need to do is they need to build her up to the 50-win thing, and then with the 50 wins, she either takes on Hayter or Saraya or Baker or something, and that person beats her at Revolution, you know, and then, you know, you build up everyone, including Cargill, from there. I'll hang up and let you know your guys' thoughts on what I just said.
Yeah, Brandon, go ahead and take that.
Yeah, I'm not opposed to doing that. I think that Cargill's reign has been impressive in the sense that they built another homegrown women's character, which I talked about Cargill earlier, her and Britt Baker really being the only truly successful acts in the women's division thus far. And I think that Cargill's success is largely due to the fact that they introduced that title just really to put on her and for her to carry it. The issue, of course, has been since that time, she's largely been relegated to Rampage, and I, which is funny considering, you know, it's on the opposite network, but anyway, I think that at a point there's going to come a time where it's diminishing returns on continuing down the path of this undefeated streak. And I think we're getting very close to that point. I mean, you can see the Nyla Rose angle has not really been firing on all cylinders. I do certainly agree with Javier's point from earlier that a babyface can work in the act of stealing a heel's championship, but not a babyface like Nyla Rose. I mean, she is not that style of babyface. It just doesn't work for that character. So instead, it makes her come off heelish. So I don't think Nyla Rose is the person to do it. So yeah, I mean, I think aiming for a woman who's higher on the card makes a lot of sense. And I do think when you spend that first Jade Cargill loss, it needs to be on someone who you have big plans for.
You have to be ready to go all the way with it, with whoever beats her. You know that you have to have the deck cleared. This is who we're going to build the women's division around for a while. It's going to be a major feud. I mean, because you can only play that card once, so make sure you prepare properly for it.
It's the mini Roman Reigns dilemma. You know, someone's got to do it, but who?
Absolutely, I agree. All right, cool. Brian, appreciate hearing from you. Ryan, I'm going to make you the last caller here. Ryan from Cumberland, Maryland. Give us maybe your two best topics because we're running so long here. We do have to wrap up.
Okay. My full prediction for this pay-per-view is Jeff Jarrett is going to score a victory on Sting. I think Sting feels that he is the Jarrett since they're the ones that helped him get, well, not necessarily got him in the business, but they gave him one of his first stages, you know, at the Mid-South Coliseum to compete on a fairly big level. So I don't know what your thoughts on that are or not.
Yeah, we haven't talked much about that, Brandon. Your thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, this is one that I guess can kind of go either way. The Jeff Jarrett thing was perplexing to me from the start. It remains perplexing to me now. I have no issue bringing Jarrett in as a as someone to work backstage, but to be an on-screen character at this stage of his career, given his history and the promotions that he's been attached to in the last 20 years, I just don't think it's the look you want. My gut says that they protect Darby Allin and Sting, because they have been relatively protected. At least Sting has been relatively protected. But Darby to a lesser extent, but I don't have a strong feeling one way or the other. I could see it very easily going either way.
Yeah. Agree. Ryan.
Better question is on this Britt Baker storyline that they're doing with Saraya. What's the deal with this Tokyo Dome match that Paige had? Was that just like a WWE house show? Because I don't even know they ran the Tokyo Dome, or was it a different federation, or is this just sort of like something she's embellishing to make herself look better than what she is?
I think embellishing, and I'm not quite sure why. That was weird.
She said that it was a botch. She said that she messed up. I'm trying to see. At first, I thought, so that's what it was. WWE ran a network special in 2015, Beast in the East, and that is what she was referring to, and that was at Sumo Hall. So it was just a misspeak on her part.
All right. Good. Ryan, appreciate it.
Thanks for taking it.
Yep, you bet. All right, Brendan, we will wrap up there. We got very long. We had an email on the Sting Jarrett thing, so I'm glad that Ryan brought it up. But yeah, I think we can wrap up there. Or is there anything else you definitely want to bring up?
I'm trying to think through the show. I think we hit pretty much everything. I'm running through the full gear card and the build they did. Yeah, I mean, I think we touched on just about everything.
Sounds good. Well, I appreciate our callers, our emailers. Always great hearing from Javier. We'll wrap up there. Don't forget, go VIP to hear our roundtable Saturday night. We'll record hour to an hour and a half of instant reaction and roundtable format just for VIP members. pwtorch.com/govip. Check out my live coverage and Brandon's live coverage in written format, running down the results of the matches, analyzing them in depth at pwtorch.com on Saturday night. VIP members get an ad-free version of that. All right. Thanks, Brandon. Thanks, everybody. We'll talk to y'all next time.